This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
You're listening to a special best of edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast with me, Michelle Owen from Soccer Saturday and Sky Sports News.
Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
And Alex Crook from TalkSport.
This week we'll be looking back on some of our favourite interviews from the season so far.
Yeah, that's right. We'll be hearing from Radio 5 Live's chief football correspondent John Murray, as well as Darren Fletcher from BT Sport.
We'll also be reliving the chat with our first ever guest geek, John Champion.
And I will be grilling my Sky Sports colleague, Kelly Cates.
Plus we'll have the best facts and figures from the international break.
That's all on the podcast that thinks the most impressive aspect of Tottenham's new stadium is the food in the press box. It's All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Yeah, guys, we must be hitting the big time if we're doing a best bits episode, isn't that meant to happen at the end of the season, though?
Yeah, but we all know that by and large, international breaks are really, really boring. There's only so much you can say about Montenegro or even Iceland, who Sam and I watched take on the world champions France on Monday.
Yeah, but I am looking forward to listening back to some of those old interviews again. It seems a lifetime ago, actually, that Crook and I sat down with John Champion at Brighton for the very first podcast. Let's start, though, as always, by looking back at the weekend in numbers.
The Geek Sheet. This week in numbers.
Yeah, rampant England inflicted record defeats on both the Czech Republic and Montenegro in the space of just 5 days.
Man of the moment, Raheem Sterling, has had a hand in 7 goals in his past 4 England games, as many as in his previous 31 internationals.
Kylian Mbappe became the youngest Frenchman to reach 30 caps for his country in the world champions' 4-0 demolition of Iceland, surpassing Karim Benzema's record.
Daniel James's goal 5 minutes into his full debut was Wales's earliest goal in a competitive fixture since Ryan Giggs scored after 3 minutes against San Marino in March 2007.
Jeff Hendrick became the first player to score for the Republic of Ireland under Mick McCarthy since Clinton Morrison netted against Russia in September 2002, a gap of 16 years and 197 days.
You're listening to the latest edition of the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast, and this week we are looking back at the best bits of pods gone by. When we came up with the idea, we all had to pick our favourite interview to replay. So, Sam, who have you gone for?
I have two, actually. We'll be hearing from Darren Fletcher later in the pod, but I want to start by going back to the very first interview we ever recorded. It was with John Champion, now working for ESPN in the United States of America, covering the MLS. But at the time, he was one of the main voices on the Premier League's overseas TV service.
I fell into it. There was no master plan. Left school at 19, hadn't got a clue what I wanted to do. I'd thought about writing, possibly, and I'd done a bit of work experience with the local paper. But the only sport I could play with any sort of aptitude or ability was cricket. And one day I played in a cricket match up in Yorkshire, where I come from. Got a few runs, retired to the bar afterwards, and the phone rang in the clubhouse, and it was the local radio station, which was the new BBC station in York, my home city, wanted to talk to me about my marvellous innings that day. By this stage, I'd had, conservatively, 4 pints of Tetley's. So I went to the phone, answered these questions, waxed lyrical, thought nothing more about it, put the phone down, went and had some more beer, and then went home. A couple of weeks later, the phone rang at home, and it was the sports editor of this nascent local radio station, saying, we're just trying to set up a proper sports department. We've got loads of football and rugby to cover this coming winter. We're looking for reporters. We are a bit short, and we love the sound of your voice. You sounded very fluent. As if, I thought, well, I better did after 4 pints of Tetley's bitter. do you fancy giving it a go? Went really well. 6 weeks later, another phone call. We think you've got something here. You've got a chance of making a career of this if you're interested. You know, all you need to do is do a bit more of this, but you have to be a graduate. This was the BBC 30 years ago, so you had to go to uni. My A-levels were so appalling, there was no prospect of me going anywhere near.
What A-levels did you do?
I did 4. I failed English. I failed music. I got a B in general studies, which was, if you remember, the paper that you couldn't revise for it. Yeah. All you could do was read the papers. So if you knew current affairs and you'd watched the news at 10 the night before, you were okay.
I got a C in that. that was poor, yeah.
And I got an E in German. So with those, I wasn't going to go anywhere nice. So I ended up at a Catholic teacher training college called Trinity and All Saints, which amazingly had its degrees validated by Leeds University. So I managed to do my 3 years degree, ended up BA Leeds, which is a complete con on my part, I have to say. And more importantly, did loads of radio every weekend, earned a bit of pin money to supplement my grant, and got the experience. And by the end of it, I was doing stuff for Radio 2, which was then what 5 Live is now. All the national sport was on there. And they were as good as their word. 6 weeks before my finals, phone call from the BBC personnel office in London. We've got a sports reporter's job at Radio Leeds coming up. We booked you in for an interview. These are the questions we're going to ask you. If you could answer them, you know, rather in this sort of style, in this fashion, it might be quite advantageous. 3 o'clock Friday, don't forget to wear a tie. I got the job. And that was me, really.
And what was your big break into the world of, you know, national broadcasting and television commentary?
Well, the big break for TV commentating was being the Radio 5 commentator the night that Eric Cantona jumped into the crowd at Selhurst Park. So I was doing that with Mark Bright, whose contribution to the moment amounted to 3 words as Cantona lunged foot first at Matthew Simmons, which was, "Oh my God!" That was Mark Bright, so I was left to carry the rest of it. He actually summed up the moment pretty well. But listening in his bath at home was a guy called Jonathan Martin, who for years was the head of sport at the BBC. And at the time, John Motson was about to have a sabbatical. And he was going to have a year off. And they were looking for someone not to replace him directly, but to come in and make up the numbers. And it was just synchronicity, really. It happened at the right time for me. It made the right impression on him. And I got a year doing Match of the Day, which then led to a permanent job at the end of it.
And that Cantona moment is something that 5 Live pay out sort of every 10-year anniversary, 20-year anniversary.
Yeah, usually,
you must hear it time and again.
Yeah, usually Mike Ingham and I get a phone call to go into Broadcasting House and go and do some programme, usually with Jim White from The Telegraph, because he was there and he's a Manchester United fan. So, yeah, every decade we do the same programme again, looking back on that extraordinary night.
And the fact you've heard it so many times, is there anything you wish you'd done differently?
Always. But I think if you ask any commentator about any salient moment in their career, they'd always say, I wish I could have done that better or that better. But at the same time, it's live broadcasting, and I don't think you can really beat yourself up too much. I think in your early years, you probably do, and you try and relive moments and think, what if? But there's no point. There's no point, because you react to the moment. I mean, I have another of those, England-Argentina in 98 in the World Cup.
I was going to ask you about that, because it is about those moments, isn't it? Yeah. You know, sometimes you get a bit lucky with that, and you were on that game, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I was fortunate to do the BBC commentary on England-Argentina, which was... People ask me if there's one game that I would pick out as being above all others in terms of the drama and the impression it made on me, and it would be that, just because there were so many elements to the story that night. But when I hear Michael Owen's wonder goal back... you know, I wish I'd done that in a different way. I beat myself up about that for years, and I wasn't as sharp as I could have been on Beckham being sent off. But 20 years on, you know, I've just about stopped worrying now.
How long does it take you to prepare for a commentary?
I guess it depends, Sam. I mean, you know this. It depends what the game is, what the sort of audience is, whether you've done those sides before recently. So when I was doing live Premier League games for national TV or live Champions League.
That would be at Setanta or ESPN.
Setanta, ESPN, and I suppose live Champions League, you know, ITV, and then more recently BT. You give it 2 or 3 days of a proper preparation. Now my life is a bit more varied and hectic in that, you know, I used to do 45, 50 games a season, so you could give each of those an awful lot of care and attention. And you turn up feeling super prepared as much as you can be. Now, I did 181 games last year.
Wow.
And about 65 days of voiceovers, you know, narrating various programmes. So consequently, with the travelling, you can't give it as much preparation. So you have to be a little more light in your approach work, shall we say, which I think in some ways actually can benefit you, because I think you can be over-prepared for these things. If you've got one prime focus per week or per fortnight, then everything's building up towards that, whereas... Now you turn up at games and out of necessity, you just have to react to what's happening in front of you. And you've got that latent knowledge inside your head because you're watching so much football and you've done so much football. So maybe that's a better way of doing it.
Do you still enjoy it the way you did when you first burst onto the scene?
Yeah, I do. It still gives me a thrill to do. And I think that's why I went down the route of the spoken word rather than the written one. Because I used to, when I dabbled with thinking of being a journalist... And I was doing work experience, I'd be given an article to write, and it'd be like having an essay to hand in, you know, that dark cloud of homework that we all remember from our school days. Whereas, because broadcasting, by its very nature, is so instant, that's just a whole lot more fun, because you're on the high wire, aren't you, without a safety net. And I think that, for me, is the attraction.
One of the other ways that our younger listeners will recognise your voice is from the Pro Evolution
soccer
games. Yes. Because you were pretty much the first football commentator to go into that market, weren't you?
Well, I think others had sort of dabbled. You know, Motti did did quite a bit early in the FIFA era. Peter Brackley, you know, we're sitting here at Brighton. Peter Brackley, who'll be here today, a huge Seagulls fan, was my predecessor on PES. He did 5 or 6 years of it. I did 8. So yeah, it was a whole new departure. And you know, when I travel around the world, I've been harangued in hotels in South Africa during the World Cup at 4 o'clock in the morning. There was one occasion where I pitched up in the midst of the World Cup of 2010, off a night flight, got to this hotel in Cape Town at 4 in the morning, and all I wanted was my bed because we had another game the next day. And we got there, and there was this guy with a beaming smile. He said, "Ah, Mr. Champion, we've been waiting for your arrival." I said, "We? It's 4 o'clock in the morning." And all his mates came out, and each of them, they'd all been out, and they decided this was their main chance to make some money. So they'd bought between them about 60 copies of PES, and I had to sign every blooming one of them before I was allowed to go to bed, and presumably they then appeared on eBay.
John Champion there, still one of the best chats we've had on the pod. My personal favourite, though, was the BBC silver tongue John Murray, who I spoke to down at Bournemouth's Vitality Stadium.
You have a reasonably broad regional accent.
Yeah.
Do you think that's helped you along
Massively.
The way?
Yeah, I do. I think that I was in a very fortunate position, and this, we're talking mid-90s. So when I moved to London, initially as a producer, strangely enough, so I was producing the sports desks largely and working on the local radio desk, which provides material for all of the BBC local radio stations. But we also got the opportunity there to do quite a bit of broadcasting, so people heard my voice, and I was in the fortunate position because at that time, and I think probably since then, regional accents have been popular, but it was at that time that you were beginning to see more and more regional accents. And strangely, before me, George Bailey had been the sort of northeast voice on BBC National Radio, and George was sort of coming to the end of his time there. He's still doing the golf, but he was doing much less football, if any. And so I think I happened to be a northeast voice at a time when that was something that we didn't have, and so I felt that gave me an enormous lift. So I always say to young commentators who've got regional accents, I say to them, look, keep it, don't lose it, because it could really be your passport to greater things.
You mentioned golf there. Obviously, you've covered many major golf events and also the Olympic Games. How important do you think it's been in your development and your career to have that versatility, and how much do you enjoy trying your hand at sports other than football?
Yeah, well, football's my bread and butter, and that's what I spend probably 90% of my working time doing and covering. But, and I mean, everyone's different, aren't they? And I have colleagues who just do football and you know, that they are thoroughly fulfilled doing that. I find that I need a bit of variety, and I like a bit of variety. And I find, even though, you know, football is my primary role, if I go away and cover the golf, or I go in and cover other events, the Olympics, Olympic sports, I find that actually revitalises me. And just to have that switch off and then switch back on, because you know what it's like with football, it never ends, does it? And even when you're off, even during the summer, it's very, I mean, you know, people who don't work in the industry will find it strange to hear us say that you do want to get away from it. But when it's your job and it's what you do, I think it is important to try and get away from it and try and take a break, because it is so all-consuming. And you feel, because it's your job, that you have to be across and aware of every major development and many of the minor developments that are taking place in the football world. So I find just that little break away, doing some other sport and thinking differently, and also a different, it's every sport you do is a different approach and requires different thinking and different qualities. So I think that actually helps you. When I come back to football, you know, very often what I've used to cover those other events, I think, oh yeah, that, you know, there might be things that I can use here with my football broadcasting.
You are football correspondent of Five Live. You're only the fourth person to hold that title. You replaced Mike Ingham. They were big shoes to fill. How daunting a prospect was that?
Well, what I like about working for the BBC is that historical thing. Well, amongst things I like from working for the BBC is the historical thing. You know, the BBC broadcast the first commentary in this country in 1927. That was BBC Radio. I work for BBC Radio. It's still, you know, the line is there. And what I like about doing this job is that there is that line back. So I worked with Mike Ingham, and Mike worked with Brian Butler, and Brian Butler worked with Brian Moore. So there is that thread that runs through it all. And that really appeals to me as well in terms of the history of football commentary, that I'm sure a little bit of Brian Moore will have rubbed off on Brian Butler, likewise to Mike Ingham, and I would like to think that a bit of Mike rubbed off on me.
We spoke to Darren Fletcher a couple of weeks ago, and he was quite honest and said that the only reason he got the job at BT Sport is because you turned it down. Is that true?
Yes, it is. It is. And that was, I think that was about 2012 time. And, you know, I've done the vast majority of my work as a radio commentator. And when Grant Best from BT, you know, called me out of the blue, it was an incredibly tempting offer. And the job that Darren does now was very much how Grant described it to me. You know, so often I think in those sort of circumstances you would think, crikey, this sounds too good to be true. But it was what he said. You know, it was a brilliant offer, and it was a very difficult decision. But in the end, I'll tell you what it was. It was probably the right offer at the wrong time. You know, and I would have loved the opportunity to do live TV football matches, which is something I've never done. I've done lots of Match of the Day games, but I've never done live TV football, and I think that would be a great challenge. But I say it was at the wrong time because at that time, you know, Mike Ingham was coming to the end of his time, and it was pretty clear that I would succeed Mike, and I really, really wanted to do that job for the reasons that I've already outlined, because of the standing of that role and also what opportunities it gives you to do. Because I'm in a job now, and when it came to the decision about whether to stay or whether to go, I'm in a job now where, when I was growing up on that hill farm, if you'd said to me that I would go and get to commentate on all of the big football matches, all of them, you know, so this is not just certain competitions, you know, all of the biggest games, England at the World Cup, you know, getting an opportunity to cover them in a World Cup semi-final and everything that surrounded that this summer, as well as the other things that BBC Radio offer me the chance to do, whether it be the Ryder Cup, the Open Championship, the Masters, Olympics, Commonwealth Games, all that.
That was the instantly recognisable and brilliant John Murray speaking to our very own Alex Crook. We have a fantastic array of guests on the podcast so far, and long may that continue. These have included Kelly Cates, who I spoke to in the Sky Canteen. I'm in the Sky Canteen with Kelly Cates, who has kindly given me some of your time before you go and present the debate tonight. Kelly, obviously you're across Sky everywhere, Premier League, the debate, you present on Five Live as well, you work for Premier League Productions, but let's go back to the start. What was your very first job in sports broadcasting, and how did it come about?
It started here, it started at Sky Sports News, and when they decided to launch the channel in 1998, they realised that it was going to require a lot of people, and probably more people that they could get who had the necessary experience. So they just employed a load of people who were fresh out of university and went, right, go make telly. Wow. So we all sort of turned up and played at making television programmes. And it was we were really lucky because we got to do loads of hours of lives, which you just wouldn't get the opportunity to do. It was just one of those moments where everybody just had this fantastic opportunity.
Thrown in the deep end,
quite literally. Completely, yeah.
And I was on air a few months ago, it was the 20th anniversary of Sky Sports News, and you were there, like on the first day,
first
with
morning.
Short hair, with
me and Mike Wedderburn.
Oh, was it Mike Wedderburn?
Yeah, me and Mike Wedderburn.
And, but Jules has been here since the start as well, Jules Waters
yes,
as well,
yes,
hasn't
yeah.
he? And how long were you at Sky Sports News for?
It would be 9 years.
Nine years,
it was, because I left. It was 2000. Well, yeah, I left 2000, end of 2006, 2007. We went over to cover the World Cup in Germany, and were based in Berlin for a while. Dave Jones and I went out, and then came back from there, and I thought, I need to go and do something different. So I left with nothing to go to.
nothing to go to.
No, I just jumped. I just went. I need to go and do something different. And if I don't go now, I'll never go. Yeah. So.
And what did you find when you left?
Well, I went and I worked a little bit with ESPN and Setanta, mm-hmm. basically all the channels that
all the rivals
either don't exist or exist in a very different form at the moment. So I did a little bit for them. Did some pitch side reporting. Did a little bit with. Did a show on Setanta Sports News, like an hour long interview type show. And yeah, then what else did I do? Then I went to Premier League Productions, as you know, which was sort of later on. But also at the same time, I had my first daughter in 2008 as well, so I was working a bit less, and it suited me not to be working as much at that time. So yeah, it all just kind of slotted into place a bit.
I think that's an important thing to touch on for female listeners of the podcast, because you know there's probably loads of women that work in sport or want to work in football and think, oh, what happens if I go away and I want to have kids?
Yeah.
Have you found it, obviously it's worked out well?
It didn't, but I didn't plan it that way, but I couldn't have planned it better really in the way that it worked. But I think if you're freelance, that there is that fear that you're not going to get the work. But because I was working for two or three different companies, it meant that I could pick the one that suited me just to keep things ticking over. Because I felt it was important not to disappear completely. That would have...
You want to still have a hand in.
You want to still be doing something that keeps your brain moving. You want to still be across everything that's going on. But at the same time, I didn't want to be away, you know, 5 days a week and kind of missing out on loads of stuff. That wouldn't have suited me. And I know there's people who feel differently and they'll go straight back in and happy to go, and you know, it's whatever suits you, but it wouldn't have fitted with me at the time. And I think it is, as much as you know there are two parents involved, I do think as a woman you take more of that on naturally, even though we shouldn't, and even though if we were talking to our friends we'd say no, obviously you share everything and it's not all on you, but there is a part of, or there certainly was a part of me that felt that I wanted it to be my responsibility.
But you managed to get that balance, and then from there, at what point did you go and do the Football League highlights?
So that would be about 4 years ago. So I must have done them for two years, maybe something like that. Did I just do a season? I think maybe only did a season there. Then came to Sky to do the live EFL matches.
Was it that Sky saw you on that and thought?
Not really. Well, because a lot of the people I worked with when I first started now are in a position to offer me work.
Which is
quite nice. But it was a little bit that, a little bit the stuff on the radio, and it was that they were looking for somebody.
Were you doing Five Live by that point?
Yeah. So they were looking for somebody to come in and host the EFL. And I think actually they were employing a few different people at the same time, so they weren't quite sure when I first started talking to them what I was going to be doing exactly. So we just had a cup of tea and a chat and sort of worked it out, and eventually that was what they came back with, was the EFL live matches, which was great fun. And then obviously getting, you know, as much as that's done in the studio, I like going to the live games. So it, you know, I did the EFL Cup as well, so you go and you do the League Cup, it's brilliant. You get to go and you know, get to go and actually go to the games and be on location, which you get a completely different feel for it, I think, from when you're sitting in the studio. Being able to do both, love being able to do both.
Now I'm pretty sure that you've been in press conferences with your dad, haven't you?
No, not press conferences.
Never presses?
No.
Have you ever done an interview with him?
Yes, yeah. I have interviewed him.
I thought it was one of the two. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, I've done a couple of sit-down interviews with him over like 20 years. I've done about two of them. Not as weird as I thought it might be, because I think we did one when they redid Hampden and they reopened Hampden, and so we did one sort of like memories piece or something like that. And the other one was just a sort of long form, sat down for an hour and chatted to him. But the thing is, because in real life I don't talk to him really about that kind of thing, you know,
because I don't talk to him about that kind of thing,
it felt like work. So even though I knew him, and the thing is, I work with people I know quite often,
friends.
So it's not So it's not that different. But it is nice to be able to talk to somebody where you know them, and where actually, if they're going off on a tangent or whatever, you can bring them back quite quickly, because you're like, yeah, no, that's not right. You don't need to worry about being too polite. you can just go straight over it. But I thought it'd be strange, but actually it wasn't, because it because of what we were talking about, it felt like work.
Yeah. And what was it like growing up in that household? You know, I'm sure many people would absolutely love to know.
And I haven't got a good answer because that was normal
for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. So I have nothing to compare it to. So it wasn't as though Dad came home and was, you know, and brought work home particularly. The game was around, like, so we'd watch if there was football on, it would be on all the time, game was on, it would be. But I think that's the same in lots of houses. So it wasn't unusual in that sense. And when he came home, it wasn't like he talked about his job, if that makes sense. So football was around, but the actual particulars of his job, he wouldn't come home and talk about. So he was Dad at home, and it wasn't strange, and it wasn't different. And like you said, there was nothing else to compare it to.
And did you always love football?
Yeah, that was. I used to go when Mum and Dad first moved down. So the other question that you normally get when people do things like this, do you remember your first game? And I'm like, no, because when Mum and Dad moved down from Glasgow to Liverpool, I was two, and my brother was a baby. And Mum didn't know anybody, didn't have babysitters, didn't have everything, so didn't have anything like that. So she'd just take us to the games. So I went from being a toddler. I think I had a few years, round about a 7, 8, 9 maybe, where I decided I didn't like it and I didn't want to go anymore. But that was just me being difficult, I think, rather than then I said, oh well, I'll come to the first game of the season, and then. After that, I was like, yeah, I think I will come back again.
You are listening to a special best of edition of the All Football Commentators at Geeks podcast. Already we've heard from the two Johns, Murray and Champion, and Sky Sports' Kelly Cates. One of the more revealing interviews we've done this season was with Darren Fletcher, who told us, among other things, the extraordinary lucky break that led him from the BBC to BT Sport.
I used to put up suspended ceilings for a really dodgy building company, and we did the Lyceum Theatre in Sheffield. And from there, I got an opportunity to essentially be a runner, I suppose, of some description at Radio Trent, as it was. And they got Gem AM, they got Trent FM. Tony Della Hunty was my first boss, who'd been the sports editor at Pennine Radio on the day of the Bradford Fire. Right. So he was kind of steeped in broadcasting, and he was at the top of the tree at the time. He'd done a remarkable job the day of the tragedy, where he'd literally helped talk people out of the stadium. Mm. You can imagine being part of that. So he was kind of my mentor at the start. And I was very fortunate because I got no experience other than being a massive sports fan. But he was the kind of guy that would give you a chance, and then he'd give you all of his knowledge, and it was kind of down to you. And previous people that had worked for him within the building were Gabriel Clark.
Oh, yeah.
Julian Waters, who had gone on, and so you kind of got something to aim at. So you thought, well, they've done it. The difference being, they were coming from an area where they were more educated than I was. They kind of decided that was the job they were going to do. So he basically got my parents in. I was 18, and he said, I'm going to pay your son $3,000 a year, and I'm going to teach him everything, and it's down to him. And he's got a bit of talent. I don't know where he saw that. He said, but if he listens and he works hard, he's got a chance. So I literally worked 7 days a week, did everything that nobody wanted to do. And that was it, really. And then...
What year was this?
This was 1990, so it was just after the World Cup, 1990. I remember the first story I ever wrote on an old electric typewriter was about the Argentina defender Nesta Lorenzo being linked with Forrest. I had no idea how to write it. And he just gradually gave me a bit more, and then he sent me off to go and do some reporting. So I'd do rugby union 1 week, and I'd do football the next. I had no idea what the scores were in rugby union. I still don't know what they are now. So I used to write everything. So I'd be watching. I'd never watched the game hardly because I was writing all these reports because I had no confidence to do it myself. And then I gradually started doing some reports, and it kind of led to doing a bit of off-air commentary.
Yeah.
And the goals were okay. I remember the first goal I commentated on, Teddy Sheringham scored it. It was an FA Cup tie for Forest. And I tried to say that he'd managed to steal a yard on his marker. And I said he got a mar on his yarker. So that was like the first one. So that didn't go too well. So it was just him giving me an opportunity, really. That was the genesis of it all.
So when BT eventually came to you, and this is probably 20 years later, when you worked at Five Live, you worked in the East Midlands, you've been on the radio for a very long time. How long did it take you to say yes?
It took them longer to say yes than me. I mean, I was going down there. I didn't think that I would be in the frame. And I was given an opportunity to go and speak to Grant Best, who was in charge at the time. I was at Five Live, and I kind of got my sights on thinking, well, Alan Green's not going to be there forever. And I think there was a theory in place that myself and John Murray would replace Alan and Mike. I think that was kind of what they were thinking of doing. But it wasn't really set in stone. So I went to speak to them, and I didn't think I'd got a prayer, because they actually wanted John. They were trying to get John to go, John Murray to leave. John had got his sights set on being the football correspondent. That was his ambition. It's what he wanted to do. So I was fortunate there that John didn't want to go, because if John wanted to go, it would have been John you'd have been talking to today. So John didn't want to go. He was the first choice. I'd got no TV experience. So I'm thinking, well, you've got no chance, really. But I had the meeting with Grant, and we hit it off as people. And again, I was fortunate again. I was lucky with Tony at the start. I then went to Five Live, and Jonathan Wall, who was a producer at the time, said, listen, can I help you? Because you need a bit of help, and I'll help you. And I said yes. If I'd have said no, God knows where, because he then helped me, broaden me as a broadcaster, help me and knock the edges off and what have you.
And he ended up being the boss.
He's the boss now, and I work for him still, so that's great. I've got a great relationship, tremendous respect for him, a lot of gratitude to him. And Grant was the same. Grant kind of looked and said, you could do this, and I'll help you do it. So I've been lucky all the way that people I've bumped into have wanted to help me. So
I think that's something that everybody needs, though, isn't it? Sort of advice and shaping and education.
Do you know what, though? I see so many people, and people ask me to... They'll write me a letter and say, can you give me some advice? Or they'll want to talk to me on the phone. And I always say to them, it takes a long time, and you've got to be prepared to really hate it at times, because you've got to work hard. You'll have experienced this. You've got to stand in car parks in the wind and rain. But I get the impression now that the ones that are coming into the business want my job and your job yesterday. And it took me 25 years to get it. 27 years as we are to get to where we are. I was prepared to do it. I think people now think, well, if I'm not doing this in 3 years, I'll go and do something else. No chance. This takes a long time. So we then met, and I got my fingers crossed that I was going to get the job, because it was a massive life change for me, both in terms of salary, profile, opportunity. It was a different skill. I'd done two Match of the Days, and I'd not done them very well. So now I've got to go and commentate on the TV, and I'm thinking, I've no idea. So I was fortunate again that he was prepared to be patient. Ian Dark was here, someone that I could look at and learn from, see how he does it. And Grant was patient, was prepared to give it the time it took for me to get a bit more comfortable. But I'll be honest with you, I'm in my fifth year now with BT, and I think it's only the last 2 years that I would sit there and say I'm comfortable as a TV commentator, because I'd done radio for so long. I used to turn up to work for the first few years dreading it, thinking I've got to get through it. Don't make a mistake. Don't talk too much. And social media can be a cruel place, but I've got thick skin, so I'm not that bothered. That was one thing I can handle. But it's only the last 2 years when I'm looking at my diary now thinking, I've got that game and I can't wait. And that game's a big game and I can't wait. But it took a period of time, and it was a real learning curve.
That Fletch John Murray story is still absolutely gold, isn't it? That's just about all we have time for on this special best off edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks. If you've missed any of our previous podcasts, and hopefully that's whetted the appetite, you can download them now via the website afcgeeks.com. Hopefully we have helped ease some of the boredom of the international break, and we will be back with a brand new guest next week.
People you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.